7 months. I only popped out for a glass of claret and a quick game of whist. Rogues Gallery Uncovered. Bad behaviour in period costume. A non-judgmental plunge into the scandalous lives of history's greatest libertines, Lotharios, and complete bastards. This episode contains adult themes and descriptions of violent acts, but no bad language, so listen responsibly. Hey, hey, we're the Mohawks. Getting into a right moral panic with the 18th century's most terrifying teenage gang, with the Mohawks. Before we start, if you are at all curious as to why there's been such a long gap between episodes, all will be revealed. Although, to be honest, it's not that exciting, after this roguish tale. But seeing as the wait's been a lot longer than I anticipated, and I'm very glad that you've stuck around, let's not bugger about with all the personal stuff, but dive right in and say, the following tale is written in the present tense of the period in which it's set, and as such may contain attitudes and opinions of the protagonists and their times which would today be considered unacceptable. As I am not a member of a largely fictitious gang of 18th century hooligans, or a permanently terrified consumer of lurid 300-year-old broadsheets, those attitudes and opinions are obviously not mine. London, 1712. People of London, beware. It's no longer safe to leave your homes at night. The streets are paved with danger, and you're at risk of grievous injury, abject humiliation, and perhaps even death from the very moment you step out from your front door. They call themselves the Mohawks, a tribe of feral young men who think it does them credit to inflict the most appalling atrocities upon decent, upstanding folk, and whose definition of humour would shame the hangman at Tyburn. Since reading of their barbarity in the pages of The Spectator, I've become so gripped with fear that I scarce even visit my garden and keep my curtains permanently drawn. I'm presently hiding beneath the table, as I could have sworn I heard a noise outside. Now, I'll own, there have always been gangs of youths roaming the capital, bringing disorder to the law-abiding. In my grandfather's day, they were known as mums and titertus. My father, in turn, railed against the Hectors and the Scourers. In fact, he used to say of being abroad at night around Covent Garden that a man could not go from the Rose Tavern to the Piazza once, but he must venture his life twice. Compared to today, how fortunate he was. As a child, I well remember the Knickers, a gang of young men who thought it great sport to smash people's windows by throwing fistfuls of halfpennies. All of these seem as innocent as babes compared to the terror which currently stalks our lives. Now, I'll be honest and say that I have not myself seen a Mohawk, or Huckabite, as they're also sometimes named, nor know of anyone who has, but the pages of the press are full of them, and the talk in the coffee houses is of little else, so I'm sure the threat is very real. I'm told the group named themselves after the Four Kings of Canada. These were noble representatives of the native people of North America who visited these shores 2 years ago and impressed all with their regal bearing and exotic appearance. It was also said that they preferred good old English ale to French wine, which made them especially popular around here. The Spectator, however, reported that they borrowed their name from a sort of cannibals in India who subsist by plundering and devouring all the nations about them, which, while being totally wrong in every factual aspect, was a powerful and fear-inducing statement that undoubtedly sold more of their news sheets. Listen carefully, for this is what I know of the Mohawks and their unholy practices. A Mohawk's sole intention is to create mischief, and it's upon that premise that all their rules and orders sit. they'll drink themselves beyond sense or reason before venturing out into the street to harass any and all passers-by, be they man, woman or child. If they can make sport or injure a member of the watch, then they're held in particularly high esteem. They even go as far as to give colourful names to their more especially refined cruelties. Tippling the lion, for instance, refers to when a mohawk pushes a victim's nose flat into their face before using his fingers to gouge out their eyes. A mohawk dancing master earns this title by stabbing their victim through the legs with a sword and then watching as they try to run away. Tumblers attack mostly women, upending them so they're standing on their heads with their skirts flowing over their faces. Some of these poor women are then thrust into barrels and rolled down Snow or Ludgate Hill. The vile ingenuity sickens me, and it doesn't end there. If you were to fall foul of a mohawk group who classed themselves as sweaters, then you would be most cruelly ill-used. Sweaters will arrange themselves around you in a circle from which you cannot escape. They then prick you upon the posterior with their swords, moving you around the circle from one blade to the next until you're suitably sweated. You're then rubbed down vigorously with a coarse cloth and allowed upon your way, the sounds of braying laughter ringing in your ears. The author Jonathan Swift writes frequently about the Mohawks and their atrocities. I remember him recalling how a maid of Lady Winchelsea was standing in her doorway after seeing out a guest with a lighted candle, when she was set upon, beaten, and her face slashed wide open without the slightest provocation. Is it any wonder, then, that I no longer stand in my own porch after 4 in the afternoon? It's the use of swords, I believe, that inspires the most fear. Mohawks, it's said, use their blades to leave permanent reminders of their vile deeds. Noses are cut in two, or in some cases, completely severed. People are left unrecognisable after encountering them. Some have their faces tattooed rather than cut, but the result, however, is the same. This horrific practice could be in tribute to the leader or emperor of the Mohawks, a shadowy figure who apparently bears the symbol of the crescent moon engraved upon his forehead. All I do know is the last time I visited a coffee house, the whole table was agog at the story of how a gang of youths had thrust their swords right through the side of one young lord's sedan chair. And it was only through God's grace that he avoided serious injury. The same cannot be said of the unfortunate watchman who was attacked in March. Around 20 young men surrounded him, wielding sticks and swords. Their intention, they said, was to nail him up in his watch house and then roll him down the street. In a remarkably short amount of time, you know, these young demons have become famous, or should I say infamous, for their deeds. The poet and playwright John Gay is writing a play about them as we speak and has already penned an ode to their infamy. If I remember correctly, some of it reads, "Who has not heard the Scourer's midnight fame? Who has not trembled at the Mohawk's name? Was there a watchman took his hourly rounds, safe from their blows or new-invented wounds?" Scouring, for those who are unaware of the term, means the thrusting of a sword into another's body. Ooh. For all their barbarity, the Mohawks never take any money from their victims. In truth, they don't need to, for all are said to be wealthy members of high-born families who, even if they were to be caught and brought to trial, could easily buy their way to freedom. Such is the fear instilled in the populace that it's recently been announced in the London Gazette that Queen Anne has become so concerned for the well-being of her subjects that a bounty of £100 has been offered by her court for their capture. I certainly hope this proves to be their undoing, or I shall never leave the house again. Sir Roger de Coverley, a fellow getting on in years, was, I heard, recently of a mind to visit the theatre for the first time in 20 years. He had already, he said, been followed home in the evening by a group of dark youths, and feared for his life until he reached the sanctuary of his home. The terror of attack would surely have robbed this venerable gentleman of seeing The Distressed Mother by Ambrose Phillips had not an ex-military man of his acquaintance offered to travel with him in his coach, both to the theatre and then home again. This gallant captain pledged to use the sword that had last drawn blood at the Battle of Steenkirk in 1692 in Sir Roger's defence should he be accosted. With the good captain by his side and with his servants flanking front and back, the carriage made its way safely to the playhouse and home again. Such is the vilification of the Mohawk name that I have read that none other than Torwar Ibn Zan Kaladar, the actual emperor of the Mohawk people, has issued a declaration in which he publicly disavows all of the nefarious undertakings carried out by groups using his people's name and has vowed to treat any and all persons suffering injury from them by his own personally appointed surgeons at a variety of hospitals he's having built for that very purpose. That was in The Spectator. It seems not a day goes by that there's not another Mohawk outrage reported by the press. In fact, the very mention of their name seems to lend wings to all the broadsheets that make reference to them. Some, including the esteemed Mr. Swift, have raised doubts as to the veracity of the whole story. It's claimed that the entire Mohawk panic is being generated by the newspapers in order to boost sales, and that in fact there's not a kernel of truth in any of it. I cannot imagine that the British press would knowingly print falsehoods just to create fear among its readership in order to increase sales. Others suspect that the Mohawks are being used by politicians of both sides, Whig and Tory, to discredit the other, a political game using voter fear to achieve its own ends. Again, I find it impossible to imagine that as upstanding citizens as those who devote their lives to politics can be so cynical and duplicitous. There are even those who claim the Mohawks are nothing more than a story told to gullible wives by jealous husbands to stop them walking the streets during the hours of darkness. Perhaps the most extraordinary claim is that the scare gripping the city is all part of a Jacobite plot to destabilise Queen Anne's government. If this is true, then my abject terror will become even more debilitating. You know, I was reading a pamphlet the other day entitled An Argument Proving from History, Reason and Scripture that the present Mohawks and Huckabites are the Gog and Magog mentioned in the Revelations, and therefore that this vain and transitory world will shortly be brought to its final dissolution. And at the end, I didn't know if it was serious news or juvenile satire. I decided from then on to walk around the house carrying a cudgel, just in case. A friend of mine, not given to fanciful notions, suspects the whole thing began when Sir Mark Cole and three of his young friends were charged at the Old Bailey for riot and assault. It's said that during a single night earlier this year, they rampaged through the town armed with lead-weighted clubs. Apparently, between dusk and dawn, they savagely beat 13 men in a Covent Garden gaming club, abused a watchman, slit two people's noses, and slashed a woman's arm so badly that she lost the use of it. They rolled another woman down a hill in a barrel, sat upon the head of another, and overturned several coaches and chairs. In their defence, they claimed that they'd set out to scour the streets of undesirables, and anyone out at that time of night was obviously engaged in nefarious business. The court took a very dim view of their actions, and they were fined 3 shillings and 4p and sent on their way. I can see how, by expanding upon this simple tale of riotous behaviour, an entire moral panic can be created for either financial gain or cynical amusement. But they do say there's no smoke without fire, and if staying safe from harm means that I must remain at home 20 hours out of 24 and only venture out wearing leather armour and brandishing a meat cleaver, then so be it. Fear, it is said, can be used by press, parliament, and those with similar agendas to control the minds of men who, once suitably terrified, will believe the veracity of any invented threat, however ridiculous. I think that's absolute nonsense. Thank goodness that I read a pamphlet written just yesterday by the journalist Ned Ward, warning of the rise of yet another gang of evil malcontents, the Farting Club of Cripplegate. He writes, and I quote, "The members of this club are so vain in their ambition to out-fart each other that they diet themselves with cabbage, onions and peas porridge so that everyone's bum fiddle might be better qualified to sound forth its emulation." He goes on to write, "Judges are appointed to discern sound quality and members drink new ale and juniper water until everyone is swelled out like a blown bagpipe and then they begin to thunder out whole volleys like a regiment of train bands in a vigorous attack. And you tell me there's nothing to be scared about. With the amount of noxious fumes being pumped into the air by those flatulent rascals, I fear the world as we know it will have ended by 1750. I'm going to hide myself in a cupboard in the basement. Do you know where I can buy a nosegay and a windproof overcoat? I'm fascinated by youth movements and the outrage and terror that they always seem to create in the older generation. From the roaring boys of Elizabethan England to the Teds, Mods, Punks and Ravers of more recent times. I'll be doing an episode about the Macaronis soon, so get your periwigs cleaned ready for that one. The Mohawks, though, were not such a movement. In fact, it seems likely that they never existed at all. Even Jonathan Swift, who once said of them, "They cut people's faces every night, but they shan't cut mine. I like it better as it is," began to suspect that it was actually all a load of scaremongering bollocks. In 1712, he wrote, "Here is the devil and all to do with these Mohawks. Grub Street papers about them fly like lightning, and a list printed of near 80 put into several prisons, and all a lie, and I begin to think there is no truth, or very little, in the whole story. My man tells me that one of the lodgers heard in a coffee house, publicly, that one design of the Mohawks was upon me, if they could catch me, and though I believe nothing of it, I forbear working late, and they have put me to the charge of some shillings already." So even though he suspected it to be complete nonsense, he found his life and his livelihood affected by the anxiety of, well, you never know. Although their notoriety faded as quickly as it had begun, it took about 15 years before people finally stopped worrying about the Mohawks. Now, I won't say any more about the idea of media and government stoking mass fear and anxiety to suit their own ends, in this century or the 18th, because everybody's got their own views about that, and this isn't that kind of podcast. If you are a member of the Farting Club of Cripplegate, however, I would advise you to keep your mouth, at the very least, firmly closed. Now, some of you who've been followers of Rogues Gallery Uncovered from its very early days may have been curious as to why there was a gap of 7 months between my last episode, about the explorer Richard Francis Burton, if I remember rightly, and this one. The truth is not very interesting, I'm afraid. It's simply that I was too busy. Completely out of the blue in June, I got offered some projects that were fascinating. Very importantly, they were paid, and they were extremely time-consuming. In making sure that I did a good job while still fulfilling family commitments at home, I simply didn't have the time or the headspace to produce podcast episodes. My main reason for doing this was, and still is, to have fun, but not to let it rule my life. And I realised that if I tried to keep all my balls in the air, grow up. I'd stress myself out and possibly end up producing stuff that I really wasn't happy with. So I just stopped. I'll be honest though, I didn't expect to stop for 7 months. However, now I'm testing the water about coming back and relaunching the podcast with what I suppose could be called Season 2, of which this is the first episode. I've purposefully, and maybe strangely, not looked at any stats or anything in relation to the podcast since June. So I really don't know if people have been listening to episodes in my absence, or indeed if anybody's going to be listening to this, but I hope that if you are listening, you will be glad that Rogues is back. Tell your friends, spread the word, rate and review, you know the drill. I hope to release an episode once a fortnight, which I think is more realistic for me than weekly, and means that I can work on other stuff, have my own adventures, and still hopefully grow the podcast. If you're a listener, new or old, and feel like dropping me a line at simon@roguesgalleryonline.com, it would be brilliant to hear from you. The address is in the show notes. You can also, of course, visit roguesgalleryuncovered.com, the website. The link to that is also in the show notes. There's a lot more roguish content on the website, and once there, you can sign up to my newsletter and become a lovable rogue. Next time on Rogues Gallery Uncovered. I like beer. Enjoy a spectacular night on the lash in Victorian London, in the company of one of the age's most energetic party animals, with Henry Waysford Charles Plantagenet Rawdon Hastings. Right, I'm off to check my stats. Happy New Year, and I'll see you yesterday.